Good afternoon, everybody, to our new home for the remainder of this session. It's May 9th, 2011, it's 3 p.m., hearing room E, and welcome to Rules Committee. And we're going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 3605. And Jim.
Mr. Chairman, this is House Bill 3605. It requires public bodies to fund their employee retirement benefits in amounts sufficient to amortize the liability for those benefits within 25 years. It applies to retirement benefits other than those provided through PERS, the Public Employee Retirement System.
Thank you kindly. Let's see. Representative Brewer, you're planning on speaking on this, so why don't you come on up? And hey, committee members, how do you like your new digs?
Awful bright.
Is it okay? Hey, you want to go back?
They seem awful familiar.
Out of town. Yeah. So he sent two staffers.
Are those these guys?
Monkeys.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. At the request of Representative Wingard and his cohort, Representative Garrett, I am to introduce myself as a CPA and writer of public transportation for the record. This is on House Bill 3605, which is not my bill, but I am providing testimony in support of it. The purpose of this bill is to bring some fiscal discipline to government and to decrease some enormous financial risk from both Oregon taxpayers throughout the state and the employees of these various government agencies. This bill requires a payment plan of various governments when they incur a liability for post-employment benefits, and this bill is exclusive of the pension benefits. This is about other post-employment benefits. Currently, these liabilities are largely unfunded with no teeth to fund them. The unfunded retirement benefits continue to compound, posing an enormous risk to both taxpayers and also to the retired employees relying on their unfunded benefits. And quite honestly, the growing liability makes the PERS makes PERS seem overfunded by comparison. And it truly is, when you look at the numbers around, truly is the subprime market debacle of government liability accounts. Until recent implementation of government accounting standards, these debts were largely kept off balance sheet. They were not communicated, but yet they still continue to incur, and they were not included in the government financial statements. Now these debts are required to be included in a footnote on the financial statements, and these footnotes have brought these liabilities to note in such an alarming way. There's also an exposure draft out there in government accounting standards to include this debt on the balance sheet. It's currently not required, but even at that exposure draft, while it will require the unfunded liabilities to be on the balance sheets, causing many of these governments to have a negative equity on their balance sheets, it still, even at that, has no teeth requiring funding. In a random sample, and what I sent to you is a random sample, the author is here, Jacob, who did the actual research for this. He'll be testifying later. But in the random sample of only 119 governments, they reflected an actuarial accrued liability of over $3 billion. This is 119 governments of approximately 1,700 out there in the state of Oregon. And of that over $3 billion of an actuarial accrued liability, only $237 million of it is funded. That leaves $2.785 billion unfunded of this liability, a 92% unfunded ratio. Now, admittedly, when you pull the financial statements of those, the dates are varying depending on the fiscal year end of the various governments. So you'll see that the actuarial valuation date is not all on one date, but the point speaks to it in aggregate that this is an alarming number of an aggregation of these various government agencies out there. The worst case is the first one on your list at the top of it, and that's TriMet. They alone are 100% unfunded with an $817 million actuarially accrued liability as of January 1st, 2010. It should be noted that they have received not one but two payroll tax increases specific for new service, but yet we have experienced deteriorated service levels. The concern is that the new increases are actually going to pay for this debt, this outstanding debt out there. This bill forces the government to save for debt that they incur. It allows a 25-year payment plan, essentially, giving them a 25-year credit card, an opportunity to make good on this compounding debt over 25 years. And it's perhaps a very lenient plan, but it will provide for solvency and peace of mind for both the employees and the taxpayers, who ostensibly will be picking up the financial pieces should any of these various government agencies file bankruptcy from retirement benefits out of control. So that's about all I wanted to say at this moment. Answer any questions if you have any. Otherwise, I'll be done. Thank you.
Representative Holby.
Thank you. It's a short bill, but it looks pretty complicated. You went on quite a while about this, and I'm just curious if you know, how does this affect early retirements for school districts, for example, which sometimes saves them money?
This, I don't know how it affects them directly. They have, they actuarially, as the benefits continue to vest when the employee is there, whether they retire early or not, is the, I don't know specifically, but actuarially there will be a debt as each employee's benefits vest, whether they're currently employed or retired. So I don't know the direct impact of early retirement on that.
Representative Wingert.
Representative Brewer, I just I want to clarify the point that you're making about how this eventually gets paid, whether what we're talking about now is just accounting for it and actually trying to get them to put aside the money now for the promises that they're making now. Yes. In reality, what is happening is they're making promises now and ultimately forcing future elected or appointed people who have to budget down the road to make up for the lost time that they didn't put money aside. And that could, and tell me if I'm wrong, but you're talking about a budget 10 or 15 or 20 years down the road in which a significant percentage of the budget may have to go to pay for these now suddenly, you know, the unfunded liability is a today liability you have to be paying, and that's going to come out of those service levels at the time. So that's, you know, that if it's a school district, it means less money available for teachers at that time or for the students at that time who need the service, or if it's a fire district, it's you know, it's money that's less money that's available at that time to provide fire service, and on with public employers. Did I have this correct?
I think you do. The when the actual benefits are paid out, the promised benefits are paid out, they are being paid out of current operational costs if no money is set aside actuarially. In the private sector, the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation kicks in and says, if you, Mr. Private Company, do not make good on and do not set aside a proper amount actuarially for the future benefits, you must pay into this guarantee fund. And what, because they recognize that you can't always pay later. What we have now, because of our aging population as well, is we have a compounding effect going on, that more and more individuals are being added into the benefit layer. It's not like we're all dying at the same rate, so we're retiring and dying at the same rate, and we've just got this rolling population of equal. What we've got is a growing population. And if we're going to continue to pay for those benefits out of current operations, you can see how we're going to be paying a lot more disproportionately out of current operations for benefits. And we really do need to be disciplined in contributing for future benefit payouts. What's interesting is the annual required contribution, which is what you should pay to match up with where your benefits or your benefits in the future will be, is actually turned into an annual recommended contribution and not a required contribution. And that's what a lot of the government agencies are actually using it as, is that's what's recommended, but they're allowing the shortfall, the payment shortfall, to continue to grow.
Thank you.
Do you want to stay here? Because in front here, I'm just curious, Representative Brewer, because I'm interested in having Todd and Jacob come up too, if they're here.
I would love to. I will move over.
Be very interested in finding out just how you accumulated where you were going with this. So whoever wants to start, if you'd identify yourself.
Sure. Co-chair, members of the committee, my name is Todd Wynn. I am vice president of Cascade Policy Institute, a nonprofit public policy research organization located in Portland, Oregon. I'm filling in for our president and CEO, John Charles, who regrets not being able to testify on this bill. He's actually in Texas making a presentation to the Transportation Research Board. I've brought with me Oregon Capital News investigative reporter Jacob Cito, who can answer any technical questions on the OPEB HB 3605, as he did the research surrounding the OPEB liabilities in the state. Now, I'm going to be brief because I've provided written testimony for the committee and the accompanying documents as well. Cascade supports House Bill 3605 and believes it's one of the most significant bills of the session. The bill grew out of the concern of the unfunded long-term public sector liabilities associated with other post-employment benefits, also known as OPEB, as we heard. These benefits include things other than pensions, such as dental, vision, and medical coverage. HB 3605 is an attempt to ensure that promises made to employees about retirement benefits are kept. In 2004, the Government Accounting and Standards Board began requiring all units of government to undertake the valuation of their OPEB obligations and state those obligations in their annual financial reports. So governments must publish the information but are not required to create OPEB trust funds or pay anything into these trust funds. And it's obviously created a significant problem as that much of the benefits are unfunded. A view last year of audited financial statements for a little over 100 Oregon governments. There's a green spreadsheet attached in the accompanying documents by Jacob Cito showed that there's over about $3 billion in OPEB liabilities. Of that, about 7.8% is funded. Most governments have set no money aside in the OPEB trust funds, as you can see in the funded ratio column of the green spreadsheet. There are almost $3 billion unfunded OPEB liabilities from 100 units of government. One can only speculate what exists in 1,700 units of government across the state. By way of comparison, PERS is funded at roughly 88% level, plus the total obligations are known. The reliance on pay-as-you-go system that's currently being used means that long-term unfunded liabilities will likely grow, creating cash flow problems for future managers, especially as the large numbers of baby boomers begin retiring. HB 3605 takes a very simple approach, requiring these units of governments to make annual required contributions, known as ARC, into the OPEB trust funds as determined by outside actuaries. It's not a new concept. Oregon statute already requires contributions for the retirement health insurance account, which is a multi-employer OPEB system administered by PERS. And by contrast, TriMet, which Representative Brewer highlighted, happens to be the poster child for this ballooning debt. TriMet's 2010 audit showed in just 2 years their liability had ballooned from $632 million to $817 million, and all of it was unfunded. While TriMet is an extreme form of the management problem that HB 3605 attempts to address, the challenge is the same across the board. Promises are being made at many governments for post-employment benefits that probably cannot be kept. The legislature should step in to take modest steps on a 25-year amortization schedule. It's rare that legislators have a chance to enact laws that would demonstrably make a positive difference for future generations, but this is one of these cases. If we do not fund these benefits now, you'll be passing the cost of current services on to future generations. You could be jeopardizing the promises you have made to future retirees. In addition, because of these OPEB liabilities, even bond ratings could decline because of riskier financial viability, which could increase the interest rate and cost of government. Cascade Policy Institute urges you to vote yes on HB 3605. If you have any questions, I can help answer, and ultimately Jacob can answer any of the technical questions as well.
Jacob, you got it?
I'm sorry? I don't have any testimony.
Okay, so you're just a bodyguard then today.
Just a bodyguard.
Okay.
He knows all the details.
Okay, questions? Representative Garrett.
Thank you. It's a very interesting bill. I'm kind of very open-minded about it, but I have a question. We're talking about public bodies. These employees tend to be represented by unions. I gather that if the unions had a serious concern that these benefits were not going to be paid, that would be a bargaining issue. So can you comment on why we need legislation here and can't assume that the representatives of these employees would be taking necessary steps to protect the bargain for benefits?
You want to
add something? Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Garrett. I was thinking about this. In fact, lacking any teeth to fund this currently, both parties at the table have... the assumption is that government will always continue and that there will always be taxpayers or somebody contributing money to the expenses for that specific government. Both parties at the table, I believe, have been rolling the dice on the future taxpayers. And without any teeth to fund this liability, I believe both parties, being the employer and the representatives of the collective bargaining, have been rolling the dice under the assumption that there will be a taxpayer in the future. I don't think this is a union versus employer. I think this is both sides need some need to know that payday should be now for at least part of it. So that's how I would respond to that. We cannot assume that government will always be in the future. These local governments, it's not clear to me if they can or cannot file bankruptcy. But yet the employees under there, if I was an employee, I would be very upset to know that my benefits that are promised are not funded at all in most for most of these government agencies.
Co-Chair, Representative Garrett, I was actually thinking of the answer to that while I was driving down here, and I wasn't too sure. I think ultimately the question would probably be geared better towards some of the unions. Maybe they could answer that question. But I think it is ultimately... it seems fiscally irresponsible. When you look at the Excel sheet, the green sheet that's attached in the company documents there, it shows fiscal irresponsibility, meaning they're promising thing now and they're hoping to come up with solutions for the future, whatever those solutions may be. So it's a way to, it almost seems, offset or put off responsibility to the future and come up with solutions later. That's what it seems like to me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a series of questions, if I could. But, we have two different tables here that look like they contain the same data, and I think they're just sorted in different ways. Okay. This white table and the green table, all the top saying the Oregon Capital News and then some other data. I wonder if somebody could go through the columns on that table and just tell us what these columns stand for, so that we could understand it a little better. And I'm particularly interested in the fourth column labeled payment, the fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, ninth, tenth, and 11th column, because I'm not certain I know what those columns mean, and I want to be certain I do.
I can take that one.
And then I have a question on a completely different piece of the bill, if I could.
For the record, my name is Jacob Cito. I'm the investigative reporter at Oregon Capital News, which is a project of Cascade Policy Institute. Co-chairs, Representative Barnhart. The first one is just the name of the government. The second column, type of plan, just identifies what type of plan that might actually be. Most of them are medical, but some of them are stipend for early retirement, whether that be cash or other sorts of benefits. Third one is actuarial valuation date. That was mentioned earlier. This is just the date that the actuaries actually valued the assets and the liabilities of the system. So under the Government Accounting Standards Board, that's only required to happen every 2 years. That's why you see some older dates there. So a lot of this information is, in fact, at a date until they can update the new liabilities and assets in those systems. The next one is payment. And that's how much they actually paid towards their OPEB plan. Yeah. And a lot of these, what you'll see is that they haven't built up any assets, even though they're making payments. And that is because the payments are for the current retirees and their current and premiums for their health care plans and what other benefits there might be out there. The next column is the annual required contribution. That's determined by the actuary in order for the governments to stay current and to pay off their past debt or liabilities associated with these benefits. This is how much each of these governments would have to make. That's how big of a payment they'd have to make in order to cash up on those old liabilities and stay current with their current retirees.
Could I interrupt here and ask you to explain what you mean by annual required contribution? Is this some kind of a government-specified item? It's something that they... general accounting principles applies, or where does that come from?
That comes from the actuaries, the outside actuaries that the government's hired to value their plans. That's made up of several components. Majority of it is for how much they'd have to amortize their past debts in that plan to catch up on it, oftentimes at a 30-year amortization rate. Another portion of that is how much they're paying towards their current retirees, and then the final portion of that is how much is accrued for current services for current workers.
Thank you. Yeah, please go ahead.
Okay. The payment shortfall deficit is just the difference between the annual required contribution and their actual payment. So that just demonstrates how much of a shortfall they had on making their full annual required contribution. The next column is actuarial value of assets. That is how much money they've set aside in a trust fund in order to pay for these liabilities that they've built up. The next one is the actuarial accrued liabilities, and that is the total amount of liabilities that they owe to their future retirees. Unfunded actuarial accrued liabilities, or short here is unfunded AAL, is just the difference between the liabilities and the assets. So that's how much they, that's how many liabilities they have without any money set aside to pay for it. And that would be the unfunded debt that these two were speaking about earlier. The funded ratio is simply the assets of the system divided by the liabilities. Covered payroll is the employee is considered to be part of the system and how much their annual payroll is. That's sort of a measure to bring all these different size governments and different type of governments into a more comparable fashion to show you how much the liabilities are of their annual payroll. For example, can I see this for one moment? The top sheet here shows TriMet on the green sheet. Their liabilities are 592% of their covered payroll for an annual basis.
Okay. Mr. Chair, could I follow up on this?
If you can make it really quick, I'd like to kind of interrupt here and move on.
Okay, then let me switch to my other topic.
Okay.
Very quickly. You in the bill, lines 10, 9 and 10, the public body must create a separate account for the funding of the benefits and make annual contributions to the account in amounts necessary to amortize the liability for those benefits within a period of not more than 25 years. I'm assuming that this is a rolling number, that as you add either new people or new obligations, that item is rolling forward. So you're never actually going to pay these things off in 25 years. And as a piece of that, if the amortization under the ARC is 30 years, why would you now go to 25 years instead? It's a combination trick question to get two into one. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Let me think about that. Hold on. Mr. Chair and Representative Barnhart, I am not the author of the bill, and I believe it is rolling, but I believe that is the intent of this. And I do believe that's a modest intent, a modest liability to allow for the government to be funded. I do reserve, though, the right to be wrong on that.
An honest answer. And the 25 versus 30?
Mm-hmm. 25 versus 30? I do not know the 25 versus 30. I don't know if 30 is a correct number on anything.
The reason I ask, if I could, Mr. Chair, is simply because it was a moment ago we were told that the ARC is related to 30-year amortization. And that's the reason I ask.
Typically, it's not to exceed 30 years in amortization period. There are governments that choose to accelerate that amortization and go by 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, and et cetera.
I see. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That answers my question. Appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Wingard, you had a question?
That's all right, Mr. Chair. Go ahead.
Okay. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to close the work public hearing on House Bill 3605 just momentarily. and I'll come back to it. And I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 800.
Mr. Chairman, we have Victoria Cox who's going to describe that measure for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 800 removes outdated evaluations, reports, reporting requirements, filings, preparations, and distribution of education laws, policies, curriculum requirements, assessments, certifications, and additional mandates from education statutes. You have dash one amendments before you, which Representative Johnson is going to address in a bit. They make changes to the membership and review criteria for the Task Force on Educator Health Benefits. You have a fiscal statement which indicates anticipated cost savings of staff time and resources to the Department of Education, although they should not amount to enough to require a reduction in staff. The impact to school districts is indeterminate at this time.
Okay. Thank you, Victoria. Senator Bonamici.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Olson, committee members. I'm Suzanne Bonamici, and I represent Senate District 17. Thank you so much for having a hearing today on Senate Bill 800, which is a very popular bill in the Senate, Mr. Co-Chair and committee members. I want to start by thanking all of the colleagues who sponsored this bill and Representative Wingert as the chief co-sponsor. This is a bill that was brought to us by a group of stakeholders that are listed on the bill. Plus, if you look at the online version, AFT Oregon is on there. They didn't get printed on the bill. That was my oversight, but they also supported the bill. But I submit that it's really Oregon's school children and teachers who are going to benefit from this bill. This came from a group that was put together by the Department of Education for the interim. Their goal was to reduce costs and unnecessary paperwork for districts by creating more flexibility while still holding districts accountable and continuing to meet state and federal requirements. This bill is the result of their work. Colleagues, we add to the Oregon Revised Statutes every day in this business, but we rarely take things away. What this bill does is that it repeals several mandates that are unnecessary or duplicative. Some examples are in the bill, simplifying the statewide and school and district report cards by putting some of the information online, eliminating some mandates relating to local school committees, eliminating a duplicative reporting requirement on race and ethnic characteristics of high school graduates, eliminating a teaching requirement for the Irish potato famine, the arms race, and conflict resolution. And I want to stop just a minute because for some reason, that seems to be the issue that people always ask about. People come to me and say, but wait a minute, the Irish potato famine is an important part of history, or the arms race was a very critical part of history, and I'll tell you a little anecdote. When I was passing this bill around for co-sponsors, Representative Jefferson Smith told me that when he was a kid, he came and testified in support of that statutory requirement. But what I want to emphasize, colleagues, is I'm not disputing that those might be an important part of history. My issue and the reason I sponsored this bill, and I think it's important to have them in this bill, is I don't think we need a statutory requirement saying that districts have to teach those particular topics. If they're an important part of history, our teachers will be teaching them without a requirement to do so, which, of course, creates a burden on the districts to go through the statutes and make sure they're in compliance. And frankly, colleagues, I believe our teachers have more important things to do than spending so much time on statutory compliance with things like Irish potato famine. Also eliminating outdated requirements that school districts record contents of student dental certificates. It eliminates the requirement that school districts withhold grade reports, diplomas, and records of students who owe more than $50. And frankly, I think it's surprising that that hasn't actually resulted in litigation. Eliminating redundant and outdated requirements that the superintendent distribute and prepare copies of education laws. So those are just some of the examples that this collaborative work group came up with when they went through the education statutes to try to find ways that we could streamline their burden. Colleagues, this isn't really a panacea to the budget challenges our schools are facing, but I believe it will eliminate unnecessary work. And as I said, if the Irish potato famine and the arms race are important parts of history, our teachers will teach them without a statutory requirement to do so. I also think that so much now is so much of the reporting is duplicative, and making that available online to districts will still provide the information everyone needs without about an additional requirement in the statute. So I know others are here to talk about the details. If you'd like some more information about the process that the work group went through to come up with this bill, I have not seen the amendment that is proposed, so I'm not going to opine about that. I like the bill the way it is, and like I said, I don't know the merits of the amendment, so I won't give you an opinion about that. I'm happy to answer any questions, but I'm a little worried that Representative Barnhart will ask a compound question like he did in the other hearing. I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Committee members,
I have no questions.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much for hearing this bill, and I encourage you to move it forward with the DuPass recommendation. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Okay, thank you. Representative Johnson, you're here. Do you want to come up front here and share your perspective?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, I am here to speak on behalf of the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 800. Do you have that in front of you?
Mm-hmm.
You have those? Okay, very good. The Dash 1 amendments to...
If you'd identify yourself.
I will identify myself.
Thank you.
I'm sorry. Representative Mark Johnson, House District 52, representing Mount Hood in the beautiful Columbia River Gorge. The Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 800 had an earlier life as House Bill 3478. This is a bill that was... We had a hearing before the House Health Care Committee. The intent was to simply refocus the attention of the task force that is in statute to examine the actual performance of the Oregon Education Benefits Board to focus on its effect on school districts. This is one of the bills that got kind of lost in the Wednesday afternoon massacre a couple weeks ago, and we are resurfacing it in this environment because it seems like Senate Bill 800 is about common sense reforms for school districts to lessen their burdens a bit and to reach out to their employees and so forth that work so hard to do such a great job of teaching our kids. So if there's one piece of news that seems to dominate our media these days, it is that our public school districts are hurting. Reductions in state school support and other factors such as the PERS rate increase have led to a great deal of financial instability. This instability is manifested around our state in the form of school district employee layoffs and salary and benefit freezes, or in some cases, reductions. The Oregon Education Benefit Board was created by Senate Bill 426 in 2007. According to OEBB's website, the board was created, quote, because of the concern about the state of the healthcare and the skyrocketing premiums being charged to school districts around Oregon. OEBB was considered an emergency, and the board became effective from the moment the bill was signed. The bill requires school districts to participate except for those who may be large enough to self-insure. Today, OEB is the only option for health insurance for the vast majority of school districts across the state. Which brings us back to today, where the past few years, school districts have seen their insurance rates increase at rates far worse than they had increased prior to the creation of OEB. You have before you testimony, I believe, from Mr. Nick Hogan, who is the business manager of Hoosier County School District, and Ron Wilkinson, superintendent of Ben Lapine School District, detailing the impact of these rate increases on their employees in those districts. These districts are not alone because most school districts have caps on their insurance benefits, and the vast majority of these increases fall on the employees. Classified employees are particularly hard hit. These lower paid employees are now seeing most of their paychecks go to their health insurance. Keep in mind that these are the employees who are most likely to be laid off in these difficult times as well. So school districts are asking for help, and their employees are asking for relief. The Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 800 would simply refocus the task force that's already in statute to study the impact of OEB on school districts that participate in the plan. It seems like the least we can do for the employees who are doing their best to help teach the kids of this state during these trying times. And, Mr. Chair, I might just add that since we had our hearing in the House Health Committee a few weeks ago, I've done a little additional research going back to the original nexus of Senate Bill 426. So I'd just like to read a few quotations into the record that were mentioned during that Senate hearing, and this dates back to February 1st of 2007. Senator Ryan Deckard was the proponent of this bill, and in this hearing for Senate Bill 426, he made the statement that Senate Bill 426 would allow additional resources to be directed towards the classroom by reducing the cost of health insurance to all school districts. By doing this, we allow the schools to increase their usable budgets without increasing revenue streams or cutting other vital services, and allow the school districts to put the money towards the programs they feel they are a priority. He also said Oregon schools cannot live within this status quo. We also had testimony in that hearing from James Sager from Governor Kulongowski's office, who made the following comments. Very simply, we cannot afford the status quo. Senate Bill 426 gives us an opportunity to bring the raising cost factors under better control. This is one more efficiency in our system to free up additional dollars directly to benefit our children. And I would also just add into the record a statement from Larry Wolf, president of Oregon Education Association. Another important point to make is that Senate Bill 426 takes money away from special interests and puts it where it belongs, in the classroom. School districts large and small see significant savings from the health insurance savings pool. The money saved by reducing fees to insurance broker and other special interests will stay in the school district. It can be applied to lowering class size, adding back programs like art and music, and ensuring a full school year. So, members of the committee, Mr. Chair, I would just be here on behalf of, I think you're going to hear from Oregon School Boards Association, but I really am here for folks at the local level. OEB has had a less than stellar performance, let's say. All the -8-1 amendments to Senate Bill 800 ask for is that the commission that's already in statute, the task force that's already been called for by legislation, focus their attentions on actually looking at the track record of what OEB has accomplished. And I would just add that there really is no way that OEB was ever going to put dollars back into the classroom. Most school districts have caps on their insurance plans. The people who are being hurt by what's happened with the performance of OEB are employees. The increased insurance rates come directly out of employees' paychecks. So with that, I would be happy to conclude and answer any questions anyone might have. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Okay, then if bring up a panel of three, Cindy Hunt, Tricia Yates, and Chuck Bennett. And whoever wants to start first, Cindy, you're up.
Co-Chair Olson, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Hunt, and I'm the Government Legal Affairs Manager for the Oregon Department of Education. You've already heard a great deal, I think, about Senate Bill 800. As to the process that we used, we reviewed prior legislation, mandate relief efforts in front of the Oregon legislature date back to at least the late 1990s. So we went back and took a look at those bills and lists. We ran and we challenged our Department of Education staff to identify unnecessary, redundant things that got in their way from doing their jobs. And nothing was off limits. We also then reached out to superintendents and administrators in the field and kind of gave them the same challenge. We asked them questions about things on the list, things like, is this, you know, doing what it intended? Are you still using this as a tool to keep kids in school? And in some cases, the answer was yes, and those kinds of items dropped from the list. In other cases, the answer was no. In fact, we've had legal issues that come up, and et cetera. Today I'm going to be focusing on a couple of specific examples from Senate Bill 800. I think you already heard Senator Bonamici highlight some of the examples from the school district level, but today I'd like to focus on some issues at the department level. So one of the areas of relief is around textbook adoption. Right now, the state statute directs the Department of Education to send out a circular for textbook adoption. Circular, you know, kind of a hard copy, you know, put it in the mail, put stamp on it, you know, to all of the textbook publishers in the state. It does not necessarily allow us to do it via email, via listserv, a website, those kinds of modern things that we have today. And when my staff brought this, you know, to our attention, they said, you know, though, you know, really, this is only going to save $5,000, you know, per year in staff time and time, you know, in addressing these things. Is it worth it to put it in there? Well, it's in here. And, you know, and there's 27 other mandate relief kinds of things like that. But if each of us came up with a $5,000 idea across Oregon, you can imagine what the effect of that would be. The other example that I'd like to highlight today is in the interscholastic activity area. Right now, the department's charged with registering these activities. These are school sports kinds of things, football, soccer, that kind of thing. One of the reasons that we have this in the list is because typically the department is pulled into disputes at the local level. So someone doesn't like, you know, a student not being able to play a particular sport, or they don't like redistricting among school districts. And what happens is that the department incurs legal fees for hearings that we must conduct, and also many of these cases end up in the Court of Appeals in the Supreme Court. By way of example, in this biennium and the prior two bienniums, we've had three different cases, the first of which cost $15,000 in legal fees going up to $30,000 because we find ourselves defending whichever side we happen to have taken in the hearing. And I can say that we don't always take the side of the OSAA or the challenger. It doesn't matter. They're contentious issues, and so they get appealed. We think that this money could be better spent on giving technical assistance to the districts and meeting state standards and meeting instructional hours, those kinds of things, instead of paying for legal costs. So with that, I've also handed out to you a spreadsheet of the 28 different mandate relief measures that highlights more specifically what they are, where they're at in the bill, and the reason that they're in the bill, and if you have any questions.
Okay.
Chair Olson, members of the committee, I'm Tricia Yates with the Oregon School Boards Association, representing the state's 1,400 volunteer elected leaders in the school districts, community colleges, and ESDs. Thanks for the opportunity to testify here today on Senate Bill 800. And we want to thank Senator Bonamici and especially Representative Wingard for taking the lead, along with several of the members of this committee in co-sponsoring this legislation. It's the very conversation for which our members are asking. I want to give you a bit of background information. OSBA, working with COSA, the OEA, OSEA, AFT Oregon, OAESD, and the department, initiated the Mandate Relief Project to identify the school district mandates and associated costs from which we would seek legislative relief this session. We met from July through September, reviewing state and federal mandates, both recent and prospective. We focused on state mandates and reached consensus on three products. One is the bill before us today. Another is Senate Bill 560, also before you today. And a third, House Bill 3370, related to local fiscal impact statements, which we hope will be the topic of discussion during the interim. We really want to thank the department, particularly Cindy Hunt, for the bill before us today. We do think it takes important steps. It's received broad support throughout the legislature. Our districts are telling us that they would really look to the legislature this session for demonstrating that you understand what they're facing, particularly in this tough fiscal time. We don't anticipate large savings from these measures, but every reduction in unnecessary reporting helps by allowing our district leaders to redirect that increment of staff resource time to a higher priority. So we hope this will be the first of many steps we take with you in assisting school districts and ESDs in refocusing our collective and scarce resources to support student achievement. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Chuck Bennett. I represent the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. For all the reasons that have just been stated, we also support Senate Bill 800. We've been working on this issue of mandate relief. As Cindy said, since the late 1990s, we did a substantial amount of work in advance of the last session and obviously in advance of this session, and having these 28 items before you, we believe, will result in the kind of time and frustration savings that would be very helpful at the local district level. I also want to support the Dash 1 amendments offered by Representative Johnson. We testified in favor of the bill in front of the Health and Human Services Committee, and we're disappointed we came up just short of advancing that bill at that time. Probably our only concern is that this could add a substantial fiscal impact. We would want to make sure that the mandate relief makes it, and so that would probably be the only caveat relative to this. But we strongly support having the task force look at both statewide and particularly district-level savings from OEBB. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Wingert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tricia and Chuck, I want to thank you for the work that your organizations have done. I know it takes a long time to move a little way on some of these issues. I had asked the department to send me a list of the mandates that didn't make the cut, and I must say that having looked through them, I think there are more opportunities for us, and I hope that this is just the beginning of a process to do what I think we should be doing with mandates already, which is sunsetting them and forcing ourselves to come back and ask real hard questions about whether something is still current and necessary, or whether it maybe has already achieved its goal and kind of changing the way we think or do things and is no longer necessary as a compliance vehicle. And I'm hoping that this is the start of what will be annual bills to remove some of the mandates on our districts so that we can let the professionals, and they are professionals, doing this work every day, have the freedom and flexibility they need to hit home runs with our kids. So thank you.
Chair Olson, Representative Wingert, thank you very much for that. We look forward to working with you. And again, I do hope that that the legislature might look this summer particularly at the bill dealing with requiring a local fiscal impact before legislation moves through the process. If you add responsibilities or new roles for school districts, that has a lot of support in the field, and we'd like to see it. And one more thing, Mr. Chair, join Mr. Bennett in his comment on the Dash 1 amendment. OSBA has supported that. I'm also sensitive to the fact this is a consensus product and it was a delicate balance, so we certainly hope that something will reach school districts from the legislature on mandate relief this session.
Okay, great. Yes, Representative Barnhart.
Correctly, the Dash 1 amendment removes the reference to the state and inserts the reference to local school districts. Would this allow the commission to continue looking at the current focus, which is savings to the state, even though they removed that language?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, I was working, because we don't have a copy of the amendment. Well, we do now.
I'm looking at the top of page 2, line 2.
Well, I certainly am going to respect your reading of it. My recollection from the discussion of this in front of Health and Human Services was the addition of school districts, and that the state the state level evaluation would also occur. It also has occurred, but would also continue to occur. So as that changes, I would have a question as well. We'd want to see it on both a statewide, kind of that macro look at it, but also our concern has been that you look at it in a broad spectrum, you miss what's happening in particular districts that have different circumstances.
I don't have any problem with the policy change you're talking about. I was just looking at the language to see if that gets us there. And it looks to me like it doesn't, and that's the reason I asked.
Thank you.
Any further? Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
The last panel, Lori, if you, Justin, and then also Tricia Smith. Lori, if you'd go ahead and start.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, committee members. For your record, Lori Wimmer, representing the 45,000 members of the Oregon Education Association here as a member of the Mandate Relief Task Force that you've heard about. And we're here to, I'm giving you some written testimony that addresses both bills because I have to be at a presentation in about 20 minutes, and I'm not sure if I'll be here for the second. So if you don't mind, I'll just make sure that you know that the Oregon Education Association supports as drafted and as before you, both Senate Bill 800 and Senate Bill 560. We believe that these two bills actually represent a really good balance between the, you know, total universe of possibilities and the world of the possible. And we would hate for any moment in time the perfect to become the enemy of the good from the perspective of those who'd like to amend the bills. We believe that this represents a consensus that was derived from a lot of heavy lifting on the part of a lot of people, and we bring it to you in that spirit. We know that there are both substantive policy mandates and reports related to those mandates that may be nice concepts or theories or ideas, but are not necessary in this time when we're $1 billion short of current services and are trying to cope with the shortfalls. We don't need to burden anyone in the education community with having to fill out those reports, if especially those ones that we found didn't actually go anywhere. They were sent to a place where they were not analyzed, they were not collated, they were not input into a computer, they were not in any way manipulated, used, analyzed, or in any way informing you of things that you'd need to know for the next policy cycle. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. I just hope that you'll be willing to pass out both bills to pass.
Okay.
Co-Chair Olson, members of the committee, Justin Black, also from the Oregon Education Association. I'm only here to talk about the Dash 1 amendments. We testified on them in House Healthcare as neutral, and again, we're neutral today. We just share the same thought that Representative Barnhart shares, that it is important to not only look at this from the district level, but also the state level. So just the inclusion of the state, we think, is important on both of these. We do have some concern over the, I believe there's a fiscal attached to the amendment, or there was a fiscal when it was in House Healthcare. And then just to also give you guys some information about Senator Telfer on the Senate side in Senate Bill 588 is looking at also changing what the task force does and the makeup of the task force. And I'll be that brief.
Okay. Thank you. Trish.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association Educators, 21,000 educators working statewide from Head Start through community colleges, and I'm here as a member of the group that put together Senate Bill 800, testifying in favor of the bill as it is before you. I also would like to testify in opposition to the Dash 1 amendment as it is written. We have a couple of concerns. The first concern is the primary purpose of this task force, as it was put in the statute, was to determine whether or not OEB saved the state and its school districts money. If you delete the language that requires that the task force examine whether or not the state's saving money with OEB, then we're not getting at the main thrust of the task force. We think that is very important to keep in the law. We don't have a problem with adding "and to participating school districts," except that you're putting a fiscal on a bill that doesn't have one, and that creates danger for the underlying bill. And we would prefer that you take this issue on its own, in a separate bill, and not endanger Senate Bill 800. Thank you.
Any questions? Representative Wenger.
Well, I just don't want to miss the opportunity to thank your organizations as well. I know that this was a partnership and that you all participated in the task force, and thank you, and also implore you to continue meeting, because I think there are many more opportunities for us to push some of the control and flexibility, more of the control and flexibility, down to the local school district level, where they can differentiate and do the kinds of things in Bend and Burns and Ashland and Portland and Astoria that may not necessarily need to be the same.
So I appreciate the work on this.
So Tricia, just really one quick question. Do you miss room 50?
You know, I got lost this afternoon, Mr. Chair. I said, what are you guys doing in E?
All right.
I heard that it was so that I wouldn't find you. I'm glad to know that's not true.
Thank you. Okay, anyone else here that would like to testify regarding Senate Bill 800? Okay, seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on 800. I'm going to reopen a public hearing on House Bill 3605 and have John Latimer and Scott Winkles. John, you can go ahead and get...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Latimer. I'm Chief Administrative Officer for Marion County, and I wear a couple other hats. I'm also the chair of the National Association of County Administrators in Oregon. And we've discussed this bill, and I'm really here neutral because I'm not sure I know what the bill does to us. Those of us that have not bargained benefits above and beyond what is required by statute, we're not sure whether we're included in this or not because of the language in the bill. Appears to us to be a little bit unclear. It says in Section 2 that the payments required are provided for in stat that it doesn't apply to payments required or provided for in statutes governing retirement benefits for retired employees. But the statutes do require that we allow our retired employees to buy health care benefits in the same program as our current employees. Now, what that does under GASB 45 is it creates an implicit difference for the cost of those retirees in our health care plan. And under GASB 45, we have to do an actuarial study, and we have to put that cost on our balance sheet. In Marion County, that's $3.4 million a year, but over 30 years, it's $28 million. Now, if we had to put all that money into a separate fund instead of pay-as-you-go, and it costs us, we figure, about almost $800,000 a year as we pay out our benefits for our employees because their costs are higher because the statute also doesn't allow us to have separate pools for retired employees and current employees. Current employees don't cost as much as retired employees, so it increases our costs. Now, so we have to reflect that in our financial statements. Now, if we had to put that into a separate fund, we would be laying off sheriff's employees, deputy DAs, and a variety of other employees, because right now, as every other government in Oregon is in the same situation, we're right on the margin of being able to fund our current services. So if nothing else, we would appreciate some clarification about whether this applies to statutorily required benefits or just benefits that have been bargained or given over and above what's required by statute. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Scott?
For the record, Scott Winkles representing the League of Oregon Cities, and I'm here to express some concerns with House Bill 3605. I would say the League is, in some respects, pleased that there's legislative interest in some of these accrued liabilities. However, from the League's perspective, one of the best things the legislature could do to address these unfunded liabilities is to address ORS 243303. That is a statute that requires us to sell or provide health insurance to retired employees. This creates the implicit subsidy that Mr. Latimer was discussing. This is a population that is about 2.5 times more expensive to insure. The statute doesn't allow us to risk rate that pool. And it's, I believe that Oregon's local governments are one of the only employer groups in the country that are required to actually provide such a service. If we are concerned about unfunded liabilities, I think I would suggest we take a look at where some of those unfunded liabilities occur. Again, as with Mr. Latimer, we do have some concerns with the drafting legislation. I had some of our finance directors take a look at this. Some of them, and we were not sure, does this apply prospectively to future benefits or does it apply to existing benefits? These are questions I was unable to answer for our members. We'd also point out that this would, we believe, would have the impact of actually creating some additional financial instability for local governments. We'd be putting money in a trust account, but not actually providing service with that. And it's feasible and it's acceptable under GASB in some cases to pay those benefits as a cash outlay. So we do have many questions about this legislation and would encourage due diligence and thoughtful work before moving anything like this forward. With that, I'm eager for your questions.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Garrett.
Thank you. Just can I get a clarification on what exactly GASB is?
It's a governmental accounting standards, and their statement number 45 requires that in our financial statements we have to record those unfunded benefits. It doesn't require that we actually set them aside. We pay as we go on those, but it does require that that they be shown in your financial statements.
Follow-up question?
Proceed.
Just who makes up GASB? Is it the national?
It's a national organization that was set up by Congress for governmental accounting standards versus FASB, which does financial accounting standards for private sector.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Olson, Representative Garrett, if I may, if you don't receive a clean audit from GASB, under GASB 45, you're not able to participate in the markets, meaning your bond rating is toast.
Yeah, so we have no choice to put those in our financial statements.
Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Chair Olson. I'm a little curious this pay-as-we-go description that I've heard. To me, pay-as-you-go means it would be fully funded. So do you mean you pay whatever the costs are without having to fund the liability?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Freeman, there is an actuarial liability that's created, and the actuaries actually calculate what that actuarial liability is. When I say we pay as we go, it's because we're paying our benefits to our employee or for our employees. But that implied difference, because we're also including the cost of our retired employees, that's the difference. We're paying that as we pay the benefits to our current employees. But they're higher to our current employees because we have that other pool of retired employees. Does that make sense?
Just a terminology thing.
If that statute wasn't in effect and we didn't have to pay health insurance, if we didn't have to allow our retired employees to buy health insurance at the same level as our current employees, our health insurance costs would not be as high because of the actuarial cost of older people being in our pool.
Another way to say pay-as-you-go would be also when a person retires and you have a certain amount of liability until they get to a point, is to take that amount of liability and put it in an account. That would also be pay-as-you-go.
Right. It only goes until they're 65 or reach
right.
Medicare.
Well, whatever that unfunded liability is for that period of time, if you accounted for that and saved that amount of money, as part of the, that
but,
would be...
But my question would be for what purpose? Because you'd have that into account that would not be used ever unless the government goes out of business.
Well, I represent parts of Josephine, Jackson, and Douglas County, and there's some discussion of that.
Yes,
there.
I understand.
That's why.
Representative Barnhart, you had a question?
Yeah, could you give us the ORS reference for the statute that you were... Again, I didn't get a chance to write it down.
Co-Chair Olson, Representative Barnhart, it's ORS 243-303.
243.303.
303.
303. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Berger.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate it. So 243303, as I understand it, basically mandates, it's a statute that says that you have to pay for these, or they pay themselves, but they only have to pay these retired employees at the best rate. Even though if actuarially you were being honest, they would be paying at the rate that older people pay, not the best rate. Correct? Is that close? I see nods. Or
that's Co-Chair Olson, Representative Berger. That is the league's understanding.
Is a statutory requirement.
Correct.
And my question, Mr. Chair, I am getting to, you indicated that we are one of the few, only, or many states that have this on the books.
Representative Olson, Chair Olson, Representative Berger, that is my understanding. This is not a common practice in employment.
Thanks.
We have a statute here for the ones.
There you go. The administrator is going to share some wisdom here with us.
They all have computers now, so that paper copies are
found. I'm looking at it.
That's what I thought.
Yeah. Okay. I do have another question. I think your testimony. You may be Marion on line 12 of the Oregon Capitol Green Sheet, and I'm not certain because it doesn't say Marion County, but it does.
I've not seen that.
It does say Marion, and it says the required annual contribution 3.41 million, annual shortfall 2.63 million, actuarial accrued liability 28.39. That's the number. I think those are the numbers you gave us, isn't it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, that is correct.
And if I could, Mr. Chair, this is entirely related to the requirements of ORS
243.303?
243. I'm sorry, 243.303.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Barnhart, that's correct. The problem is that under that statute, it not only mandates that we allow them to buy health insurance from our plan, but it also says we can't have separate pools.
Right.
So we can't have a pool for our current employees and a pool for the retired employees.
Right.
That would reduce the cost.
Mr. Chair, if I could, I think what you just said is that you can't charge them a different premium.
That's correct.
That's what you meant by not separate pools, isn't it? Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Interesting. Okay. Any further questions?
Then if I could just comment, if you wouldn't mind. This has been ongoing as long as the statute, and I don't know when it was enacted, has been on the book, but it wasn't until this new accounting methodology came forward that it became evident of the difference between what was the cost of the purchase and the difference in value in if you were to buy it on an insurance pool, if that makes sense. In other words, it was this new accounting standards that put this into the balance sheet. It was been there for quite a while since the statute was basically enacted.
Mr. Chair, if I might, Representative Berger, you're exactly correct. GASB 45 is a fairly recent pronouncement by GASB. We didn't start our actuarial study into 2008. That's the first time we put it on our financial statements. The actuarial study is required by GASB. It costs us about $84,000 every 2 years to do that actuarial study.
Okay.
Okay. Is there anybody here from TriMet? Would you be so kind as to want to come up and share your perspective on this?
While they're coming, Mr. Chair, I'm wondering how many of these items on the green sheet are just like the one for Marion County, where the requirement comes out of the statute and not something that the local board did. I don't know the answer, but I'd be curious about it.
Well, Representative Barnhart, we might have a little bit of information lightning here right now.
Might pass around the sheet that shows it.
You want to just hand it over?
If you want to hand it over there to Amy, that would be great.
I've only got one copy.
Yeah, okay.
You have a second administrator.
We're not used to sharing.
If you'd identify yourself and go ahead. Yes.
Mr. Chairman or Co-Chairman, this is Olivia Clark. I'm the Government Affairs Director for TriMet. Here to answer your questions and address the bill, sort of the 800-pound gorilla in the room, I think. And I have to just say for the record, I'm going to curse my CFO, who was not available today. She's actually, the irony of it is she's been called by four other of the largest transit agencies, I think, in the country in her capacity as a CFO and 25 years in public finance and primarily working as an investment banker to advise them on their debt policies. So I thought this was just kind of an irony. And if I can't answer your questions, I will drag her back in here. But for the record, Mr. Chairman, we believe that the bill, the impact that it would have on TriMet if it was passed, and we're not absolutely certain, but we think it would cost us something around $75 million a year. Mm-hmm. And that's both the pay-as-you-go piece, which is about $14 million for us this year, and then the remainder of the what you're calling the unfunded liability. The TriMet board, a new board, and the new TriMet management is fully understands the situation, is fully cognizant of it, acknowledges it. We abide by the GASB 45 that you've heard about. We do pay as you go. We have established a retiree medical trust that we fully intend to gradually fund. We're not in a position to fund that right now. But I have to say that even before GASB 45 came out, and we reveal everything in our financials, we started to right the ship, I think, in about 2003 by working on the non-union side of the ledger. By changing our health care benefits for non-union employees and by moving from a defined benefit retirement program to, a defined, how does that work, defined benefit versus the other benefit? Defined contribution, excuse me. See, I need that CFO. So since that time, the TriMet board, which is a fairly new board and new management, has adopted a policy to bring total employee compensation, including wages and benefits, in line with a sustainable financial forecast. So we're solving the current problem under GASB in three ways I'd like to share with you. As I said, we're doing the pay-as-you-go, and I think Mr. Latimer referred to that as one option under GASB. We're also attempting to cut costs for current and future retirees to lower those costs. We're in the middle of what you may have read about, a protracted conversation with the Amalgamated Transit Union. And we're also, we established a way to deal with the unfunded liability with a retiree medical trust we've established. So just to conclude, I would say that in some ways our unfunded liability is also a result of a perfect storm. You've heard some of that from the other witnesses, how those things are calculated. But the health care premiums for us, and as for many, the last 10 years have gone up by double digits. And you could see that our unfunded liability took a huge jump from, I think it was $640 million to over $800 million. We also have excellent retiree medical benefits, probably some of the best in the state, which is a part of that. And we're suffering from the worst recession that we've seen since the 1930s. And I would call that a perfect storm in terms of our ability to deal with that liability. But with that, I'd be open to your questions.
Representative Winger.
I'm sorry. Tell me your name again.
Olivia Clark.
Olivia. Thank you. I have a couple of questions about the retiree medical benefits, which you characterized as the best in the state. I think we may be able to establish very quickly that they might be the best in the country among transit agencies. Correct me if I'm wrong, but do you offer the
medical benefits to all of your retirees and their dependents?
Yes. Mr. Chairman.
It's pretty extraordinary. Follow-up? Mr. Chair?
Proceed.
Thank you. So you have created the Retiree Medical Trust, and I heard you testify that this bill would cost TriVet probably $75 million. What I infer from that is that the payment that you probably should be putting aside in order to meet this obligation is $75 million per year. And that, if I also heard correctly, the amount of payments that you're currently making or putting aside is zero?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wingard, we're, as I mentioned, the $14 million of the $75 is the pay-as-you-go. The $61 would be the unfunded. As Mr. Latimer mentioned earlier, the bill, I think, would require that we put that money aside to sit. That would, just leave it at that.
Follow-up. Just for clarification, above the pay-as-you-go amount, how much is TriMet setting aside?
I think in the current budget year, the proposal is somewhere around $500,000.
Follow-up. My understanding is that it's $435,000 and that it's for FY12, not this year. So no payment this year and then $435,000 next year.
Mr. Chairman, excuse me if I misspoke. I was thinking about FY12. I'm not sure if it's 430, or maybe I rounded up to 500, but I can double-check and get back to you on that.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Holby.
Thank you. Olivia, has the other post-employment benefit obligation, has it affected your bond rating or any of your dealings with the Federal Transit Administration?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hovey, no. We're a AAA bond-rated agency. We have clean audits. I think complying with GASB 45 is a requirement to obtain a clean audit, but I think we're in very good stead with the Federal Transit Administration as well.
Thank you. Anybody else? Okay. Trish, thanks for coming up.
Thank you for inviting me.
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3605, and I'm going to open up a work session quickly on Senate Bill. What that whatever it is. 273.
Mr. Chairman, this is Senate Bill 273A. It reduces the maximum penalty from $5,000 to $1,000 for failure to file a timely expenditure statement for late filing of statements of economic interest and for a legal expense trust fund late filing of contributions received and expenditures made by a trustee. There's no amendment on this. You have a fiscal statement that came over with the bill from the Senate that has the statement has been issued.
Representative Holvey.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 273 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Holvey moves Senate Bill 273A to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Amy, would you call the roll, please?
Representative Garrett.
Aye.
Representative Holvey.
Aye.
Representative Winger.
Aye.
Representative Barnhart.
Aye.
Representative Berger.
Aye.
Representative Freeman.
Yes.
Co-Chair Hunt.
He's excused.
Olson.
Aye. Senate Bill 273A passes, and who would like to carry that? Anyone?
I did.
Okay. Representative Berger, thank you. We'll close a work session on 273A, and we will open up. Get that. There we go. Get that. Thank you. Going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 26.
Mr. Chairman, Victoria Cox will do that one. I see she's not here. So let's see what
she can do. There she is.
Here, do you want to summarize Senate Bill 26?
You can.
Thank you.
you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 26 eliminates registration of private elementary and secondary schools by the Department of Education, declares an emergency effective July 1, 2011. You have a fiscal statement which indicates that the Department of Education anticipates cost savings of staff time and resources. Measure will not require a reduction of staff. Minimal expenditure impact is anticipated to the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission.
Okay. Thank you, Victor. Cindy, if you'd be so kind to come back up.
Co-Chair Olson, members of the committee, this is the second bill in front of you today in our three-bill mandate relief package today. This bill, the Oregon Department of Education introduced, the bill currently registration of private pre-K through grade 12 schools is allowed but not required with the Department of Education. Right now, there is approximately 367 of these private schools that are registered with the Department of Education, and the schools do not pay a registration fee, so this activity is entirely generally funded. As we were going through our budget reduction exercise last year and identifying anticipated cuts to our budget, we identified this as one of those activities that we put on our cuts list, frankly. I think you already heard that there is a fiscal, a positive fiscal impact of this bill. It would save approximately $100,000 per biennium. Also, to be clear, the registration of the private schools, it's a fairly low threshold right now. The schools must certify that they're offering the same number of instructional hours as public schools, curriculum's consistent, and that the academic standards are met. But also, private schools currently, the ones that are more reputable are accredited by a private accrediting organization. Another question that I wanted to make clear that's come up around this bill is that private schools right now access the department's services for criminal background checks. That would continue after this bill. And then other health and safety and kind of child abuse kinds of requirements that currently apply to private schools would continue also after this bill. So with that, I'm open to any questions that you have.
Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Charles. And thank you for doing the work on trying to find cost savings within the department. My only question is, as you do a positive fiscal, is it your anticipation to get rid of an employee, or how does that, I mean, is there one person that pretty much spends all their time doing this?
Right. Co-Chair Olson, Representative Freeman, there is one employee at 0.75 FTE for 6 months that's dedicated to these activities, and then the rest of her time is dedicated to other activities within the Department of Education. When you talk about getting rid of an employee, within the department, we're subject to collective bargaining agreements and that kind of thing, so when we eliminate a position or part of a position, those employees often have bumping rights and that kind of thing. But what we anticipate specifically with this particular employee is that her time would be shifted over to private career schools, which is another growing area in our agency.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean the specific employee, but your budget next time will have 0.75 FTE less.
Co-Chair Olson, Representative Freeman, correct. And as I said, this was on our cuts list at like number 7. Okay, so it's, you know, as one of those budget reduction exercises. And so yes, the FTE would be reduced as well as the, you know, the amount of the budget that corresponds with that.
Follow up. Go ahead.
The reason I say that is it's related to the cut services we provide, but if we don't cut the amount of people we're paying to provide those services, we really haven't saved any money. We're dealing with some of that around healthcare right now, so I just want to make sure as we talk about cutting services we're currently providing, we're talking about having less people to do those services.
Okay. Representative Holdy.
Thank you. Ms. Hunt, you had mentioned that the Department of Education provides criminal background checks for these private schools?
Is that correct?
Co-Chair Olson, Representative Holvey, that's correct. A private school can choose to access those services. Those criminal background checks include both the LEDS and the FBI check, which would be nationwide. We charge a fee for that, and that service is funded with those fees.
Thank you. Anticipated my question.
Okay. Any more?
Gee.
Well, thank you very much. Cindy, might as well just stay there for a moment. I'm going to close. Anybody else want to speak on Senate Bill 26? Okay, seeing none, I'm going to close public hearing on Senate Bill 26, and I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 560A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 560A allows school districts, in lieu of filing biennial continuous improvement plans, to certify that self-evaluations were conducted and that the previous plans were not substantially changed. Takes effect on January 1st, 2013. Once again, you have a fiscal impact statement, which indicates that cost savings of staff time and resources will be seen by the department without, not received a response from school districts in terms of any fiscal savings to them.
Okay, thank you, Victoria. Senator Johnson, if you'd be so kind to come up here and kick this off for us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My prop is coming down. I'm going to ask permission to use a visual. It will arrive momentarily. But just figure that I've got the Portland phone directory, and I'm going like this. I was at a public meeting, and I had one of my for the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I represent Senate District 16. I was at a public meeting in my district and had one of the superintendents drop this weighty tome in front of me and say, "Does anybody look at this down in Salem?" I didn't know what it was. And so I perused it, and it turns out to be the district's continuous improvement plan. So I called up the agency, and I said, "Does anybody look at these 198 school districts?" Is that right? 197. All of them, Rainier's a little tiny school district producing this great big tome. I said, "Does anybody look at these?" And the answer was generally no. We pick out a few for kind of random look at, and the rest of them we don't look at. And so that was the genesis of this bill. When you look at it, and it'll be down here in a second, thinking about the amount of time, money, energy that went into gathering the information, typing it, collating it, binding it, sending it, and to have it really be a not very meaningful exercise. It results in no dialogue between the district or very little dialogue between the district and the agency. It just seemed to me at a time when every nickel counts in this process that this was one of a series of mandates that was just simply not necessary. In its absence, no great evil will fall on the department or the school district, and I commend Senate Bill 560 for your thoughtful consideration.
So I take it this is
the aforementioned home. This is Rainier. Can you imagine what Hillsborough or Beaverton or Eugene, what theirs looks like? This is little bitty Rainier on both sides. And with no real value coming out of this exercise other than supporting the timber industry, which in and of itself is a laudable goal, let's get rid of this. That ends my testimony.
I always thought you like cutting trees down.
I do like cutting trees down, but I especially like cutting trees down for good and valuable purposes, and this, I submit to you, ain't it.
Okay. Thank you.
Cindy Hunt, Oregon Department of Education. We want to thank Senator Johnson for introducing Senate Bill 560, and we worked with her to amend the bill on the Senate side because one of the issues with the continuous improvement plan, using the visual aid here, is that it's tied into various federal requirements. So as we were talking about mandate relief, we were looking at the continuous improvement plan and started examining this and saying, okay, what of this can we eliminate? Can we make it so that the improvement plan is submitted less frequently? All of that kind of thing. And as it turns out, most of what's in statute around the continuous improvement plan is tied to federal requirements. So if we don't do it, we give up federal dollars. So we worked on amendments to lessen the requirements and give more flexibility to school districts and to the department around how frequently these are submitted. In current statute, it's every other year. What we said instead in the A and Gross bill is that it could be periodically, but no more frequently than every other year. The reason that we left in every other year is that the last time the feds were here monitoring us, they wanted, frankly, they wanted us to have school districts submit these every year. But because we had a state statute that said every other year, they backed off. So that's why we don't want to lose that minimum, because the next time we're monitored, we don't want them to come in and say, no, every year on this. The other thing that we did in the A and Gross version of Senate Bill 560 is allow for these to, you know, I talked about them being submitted periodically, but also allow for them to be submitted when there's a substantial change in the district. And in my testimony, I have examples of what a substantial change might be. For example, changes in student demographics or instructional staff, financial resources available to the district, that kind of thing. What this bill allows us to do is continue the work that we've started around revamping this. Right now it's an electronic form that comes in, and we've also suspended the submission of these forms over the course of the next couple of years while that work is going on, so our districts do not have to submit these to us during this time period. With that, I'm open to any questions.
Representative Wingert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sydney, couldn't we make these things electronic so that they could be updated rather easily, and and then they could either be submitted to the Department of Ed or not? But I realize that that has a, by the size of these things, will have a significant impact on the timber industry in this state, but still, I would think that others might find better uses for the paper.
Co-Chair Olson, Representative Wingard, they are electronic now, and it's called the ESIP. Technically, they reside on a server at the Department of Education that districts come in and they update them. I believe districts do print them and keep them in their district as well. So this is still a good visual aid. I don't want to take away from the visual aid here. But as far as them submitting them to the actual, you know, department, it's all electronic.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
If Tricia Yates and Chuck Bennett, and Trish, do you want to chip in? No, you're good. Okay. I just, you know.
Thank you, Chair Olson and members. Again, Tricia Yates with the School Boards Association. Thanks for this opportunity. This is a good bill that should pass. It's a paperwork reduction bill. If the legislature passes this bill and Senate Bill 800, you will have passed two-thirds of the products brought to you by the Mandates Relief Project, and we urge your support. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Chuck Bennett with the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. We also support the bill. I do want you to know, though, the continuous improvement plan, school improvement plans, all the rest of them do serve some purpose at the district level, and certainly assist administrators and staff in sort of guiding the overall direction they're headed. But as the senator pointed out, there we hit a point where it gets beyond what's needed, and certainly with the requirement that as the plans are significantly updated, it's filed with the department, we think that's sufficient. It's one of the big complaints in districts is a continual belief that there is one of those rooms you imagine from Raiders of the Lost Ark where all of this paperwork gets boxed and never seen again, and this would help in relieving people of what we hope is a myth. And this is a very good bill. We really appreciate it.
We have top men working on it.
Yeah.
Top men.
Any follow-up? Do you have additional follow-up? Okay.
Thank
you very much for bringing this, for the work you've done on that. Okay, you're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 560, and going to work, open up a, let's see, I think we have
everything's
possible.
At,
yeah. A public hearing and work session on HCRs 26, 27, 28, 29, 30, 31, 32, 33, and 34.
Do you need a motion?
No. Jim.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, HCR 26 honors Oregon State Police Sergeant Richard J. Schoening. HCR 27 honors Oregon State Police Senior Trooper Maria Magnano.
Mignano.
Sorry.
Good luck with the next one.
HCR 28 honors Albany Police Officer Jason Haroff. HCR 29 honors Oregon State Police Trooper Scott A. Lyons. HCR 30 honors Oregon State Police Senior Trooper William R. Hakim. HCR 31 honors Oregon State Police Sergeant James D. Rector. HCR 32 honors Oregon State Police Trooper Dan A. Nelson. HCR 33 honors Oregon State Police Superintendent Holly Holcomb. HCR 34 honors Woodburn Police Captain Thomas Paul Tennant.
I'd like to invite up Representative Olson and allow him to use the visual aid if he would.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Vice Co-Chair. Okay. Committee members, my name is Andy Olson, and I almost started out saying Lieutenant with the Oregon State Police, but those days are gone, so I'm a member of House of Representatives from Albany area. The what you have there right in front of you right now with all the House, the HCRs there, is a accumulation of about a total of 11 different incidents, 14 different members, that we did a little bit of research. And I'll just give you a real quick overview. House Bill 3039, you've not seen yet. It's come out of transportation and is down in Ways and Means right now. And we're waiting to kind of finalize where we're going with the funding mechanism there. Right now, the Oregon State Police Officers Association is wanting to shift dollars in to pay for signs that would be officer memorial signs out on the highways for that identify the locations of where the members that of the officers that had died during different incidents over the past several years that Jim just shared with you. I'm not going to go through each one of them particularly, but Mr. Stenbridge did a great job in showing a photograph of each of the members that are identified there, too, in the HCRs. The reason that HB 3039 occurred was last year I had received a phone call from, at that time, Jeff Lady, who was the president of OSPOA. And he had some serious concern because he had just received information that the two crosses that were located alongside Interstate 5 just south of the Ankeny Hill exit, which would be halfway between Salem and Albany, were possibly going to be removed by ODOT because someone had called the governor's office and had some concern regarding those memorial crosses. And they were on state right-of-way. So with that, I did a little bit further research and noticed, and it always kind of intrigued me with California, Arizona, Texas, and a number of other states around the country that had identified a memorial sign for a fallen officer. So we did a little bit of homework, and therefore that's what we came up with House Bill 3039 right now. What we've done is we've gone back to 1960, my staff, and we've researched all the incidents involving troopers over the years, and a number of them have occurred with deputies as well as officers from other agencies that have been involved in the incidents as well. So that's why you have two incidents involving Jason Haroff and then Tom Tennant from Woodburn Police Department. This is our, we're doing this in stages right now, and a lot of it has to do with the locations. And you'll kind of understand this as I go through this. The first location that we've identified, obviously, is the Woodburn milepost 272, which would be up near the Woodburn exit. And at that, you would identify Bill Hakeem, who is the senior trooper, who and Tom Tennant, who's the captain from Woodburn Police Department, that, you know, died as a result of an explosion from a bomb a couple of years ago. We would put a sign up alongside of Interstate 5 and identify that as the Officer Memorial Highway. And that would be for specifically 1 mile. So you'd have one going northbound at 272, which would identify that incident. And then as you're 273 coming southbound on I-5, then you'd also see that. So you'd capture that 1 mile. The next part would be Ankeny Hill Road, which would be milepost 243. Know these like the back of my hand. And that would involve Maria Mignano, who was a senior trooper with the state police at the time when she was killed, as well as Jason Haroff. Now, I knew Jason Haroff really well, and he'd only been with Albany Police Department for 9 months at the time that he was killed, but he was, you know, John Burright, who was a sergeant out of the Salem Patrol office and lived down in Albany with the state police, was actually, I mean, John was considered a hero to Jason, and at this point right now, John is still, I mean, he's just kind of in a limbo-type state all these years. So we would put a sign up there. Then the next one would be Highway 97 in the Gilcrest area. That is with Sergeant Jim Rector and Trooper Scott Lyons. And they were killed as a result of a log truck. They were actually riding together in a Ford Mustang, and Scott was driving, made a wrong turn on the Crescent Bypass coming over from Gilcrest toward Highway 58, and didn't notice this log truck and were killed, I mean, immediately on that. Happened to know both of those guys. We are going to actually post at, it would be about mile post, I think, 182, and that would be on the, or 185, that would be on the south end of Crescent, and then it would end a mile later on the north end of where Gilcrest ends, and that's on Highway 97 to identify them. And then the last one would be Interstate 5, and that's the Salem area, and that would be also in near where the Salem Patrol office is located at, off of milepost 258. And that's just a little bit north of Market there. And again, this is for those three people there, that Holly Holcomb, who was our superintendent, who was shot and killed just across the street here in front of the public service building back in 1975. I'd been on the state police for about a year and a half when that occurred. He was truly a pretty good superintendent for us at that time. Another one that we would put on the sign along with that would be Trooper Dan Nelson. I did not know Dan, but his brother, Ron, became a member of the state police down in Cottage Grove and then transferred over while being promoted up through the ranks and retired over in Bend. And then the last one would be Dick Schooning. And Dick, and I knew Dick from when he became a member of the state police back in 1979. Where he was a member of the bomb squad and had an unfortunate accident trying to show a class how to dismantle blasting caps, and they blew up and I mean opened up his chest, and he died that way. So that's just a portion. We do have another set of officers as well that we'd like to do that to across the state, but that would come in February next year is what we're thinking. So you're kind of getting a capture of this. The other thing, too, that I'd like to share with you, too, we would not do all these all in one day. Just as you see right there in the segments of, like, Woodburn and Ankeny Hill, we'd like to have the families all come in just for those two, and then another day capture the Gilcrest and also the Salem area. So you'd actually have two events that would occur on the House floor.
Thank you, Representative Olson. Questions from the committee? Not seeing any questions, Representative Olson. As I note that you do deal with a lot of us police-related issues, you know, I sometimes think, what's he doing this for? And now that I see this, I want to thank you for bringing it forward. We just had a recent incident down in the Eugene Springfield area, as you may know, a couple weeks ago, and seeing what our frontline police officers go through and what the risk they take, I just want to say thanks to the troopers, and I think this is a good idea that we do this and honor them.
Yeah, appreciate that, Representative Holden. It would be neat, you know, eventually someday maybe to identify a mile on Interstate 105. Mm-hmm. You know, someday that would be pretty neat. Anyway, thank you.
Not seeing anything else.
Work session.
Yeah.
Oh, you want to open a work session?
You're in a work session.
Oh, I'm in a work session.
You are?
So do I have a motion?
Mr. Chair?
That sounded weird.
Would you like me to do them one at a time or all together?
You can think all
together. You can do them as a block.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I would move HCR 26, 27, 28, 29, 30, 31, 32, 33, and 34 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Winger,
adopt
HCR 26, 27, 28, 29, 30, 31, 32, 33, and 34 to the floor with a due adopt recommendation. Discussion. Seeing no discussion, Amy, can we have a vote?
Representative Holby.
Aye.
Representative Winger.
Can we vote on eight bills at the same time? Aye, eight times.
Representative Barnhart.
Aye.
Representative Berger.
Aye.
Representative Freeman.
Yes.
Representative Garrett.
Aye.
Co-Chair Hunt.
Excuse.
Co-Chair Olson.
Aye.
Check with Mr. Sternberg. We can do one vote on eight different resolutions at one time.
I think as long as it's clear, and I believe that there are no objections to any of these. If anybody objects to any of these, we could separate them out.
And that was the motion, so I wouldn't think that it's a good deal.
Let's adjourn. Waiting for one moment. You better adjourn before she gets it. Gavel.
So
what is the work session?
With that, do we have a carrier for these resolutions? Representative Olson. So with that, all these resolutions have now passed, and I'll close the work session on HCR 26, 27, 28, 29, 30, 31, 32, 33, and 34. And any other business?
We're adjourned.
The House Committee on Rules is adjourned for today.